From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz provides an update on the kidnapping of hundreds of girls in Nigeria, and Joshua Landis joins us to discuss this week's Syrian rebel departure from Homs.
But it means that the civil war goes on in Syria, and the rebels have been fighting amongst themselves, and now the battlefront has moved up towards Aleppo.
And later, my conversation with longtime China scholar David Lampton. He argues the country's leaders have to reconcile a fragmented bureaucracy with explosive economic growth and a rising middle class.
There's a debate what the middle class in China is, but it's probably as big as the United States population. And that still leaves you with a billion poor people.
Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. Coming up after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Rebecca Cruz, Joshua Landis, another busy week. Rebecca, let's start with you, an update on Nigeria. Now, we've talked about this before, a few weeks ago, actually, before many in the press were really getting up in arms about this. Now, you know, there's quite the outcry about the kidnapping of the 200 girls in northeastern Nigeria. Boko Haram has now taken responsibility for that incident, is now threatening to sell the girls on the open market, which raises all kinds of questions about there being markets for children. But Al-Qaeda also seems to come out and separate itself or suggest that Boko Haram does not have their support. So a lot of new developments, except for the fact that the girls are still unaccounted for, cannot be found.
Yeah, most of the girls are still unaccounted for. And there was actually another kidnapping this week of another half dozen or so girls that were thought to also have been taken by this group. It's obviously a very sad story, one that hasn't been paid enough attention to. And once it came out that they were seeking to sell them on the market, and yes, there is a pretty big market for women in particular, but also, of course, young girls and boys as well, all over the world. And so that's very unfortunate, but that caused an even greater outcry, and we're now starting to see international attention. You mentioned social media. This is where much of this is coming from. This hashtag bring back our girls has really become the hallmark of this movement. And we did see the president kind of Nigeria finally say, you know, we haven't necessarily handled this correctly. We perhaps will take some help. And Obama has offered that help. John Kerry has said that it will be swift and rapid. And the United Nations has threatened that when these perpetrators are caught, that international law will be used to its fullest extent. The issue, of course, is that this happened 2 weeks ago. These girls are probably not all together. We're not sure where they are. They're probably in little pockets here and there, and hopefully they haven't been sold yet. But that is, of course, a possibility. So this may be a little too late in the game.
Well, what kind of help is the U.S. offering specifically? It's special forces? I mean, they aren't going that far, right? Or investigators, search parties? What exactly are we offering?
Yeah, they're sending some military personnel, some intelligence, as well as some hostage negotiators. Of course, we're talking about human lives. So even if they are in a larger group, this isn't going to be some large charge in and get them and rescue them. That's not likely to happen. You know, there's a number of comparisons, of course, with the situation with Kony in Uganda. The United States did send some assistance. They had sent some before Kony 2012, again, a media campaign, social media campaign. And that was a couple of years ago, and he still is at large. Now, there are very different situations, but there is some concern that they'll be facing, again, many of the same geographic barriers, being in the bush and being in an area they're not familiar with.
All right. Thanks, Rebecca. We'll continue to pay attention to that. But Joshua, big developments in Syria this week. The Syrian rebels were defeated in the town of Homs. It was an area of Syria that they've held for almost 2 years. And now they've had to surrender to the government forces and left the area. So what are we to make of this development?
Well, it's the third largest city of Syria. It was the capital of the revolution, where the revolution really first took root in a major part of Syria. The government has surrounded that area for the last year, pounded the downtown old section of town, which had been the rebel stronghold, and starved people. Finally, the rebels made a deal. They got to pull out several hundred fighters who were still there with their guns. The UN put them in buses, took them up north where they are now joining their comrades up north. But the town is in government hands. And we've seen a number of developments. Jadaba, the head of the Free Syrian Army, the political head came to Washington this week. He met with Kerry. He's met with Congress. So the United States has given him a berth in the U.S. And They've supplied TOW missiles, these anti-tank missiles that are very effective, to the rebels. And the United States is in a sense, it's not a big boost for the rebels, but they're trying to put them on some kind of life support, I think, just to keep them alive. But it means that the civil war goes on in Syria, and the rebels have been fighting amongst themselves.
But they're losing steam, right? I mean, this is a big indicator that they're losing steam, the rebel movement.
They're defeated in the third largest city, and now the battlefront has moved up towards Aleppo, the northern capital. It's the second largest city in Syria. It's been a battleground, and the government is making advances, and they're taking back territory. But the city has been devastated. Barrel bombs by the government, these crude bombs that are chasing people out of the city. Two-thirds of the city have left. Many are in Turkey. It's devastation.
Well, the United Nations is responding. I think France has drafted a Security Council resolution to refer the Syrian government to the International Criminal Court. We don't know if this will go forward, but is this likely to happen, do you think? I mean, is this something that needs to be addressed in terms of war crimes?
Well, it is absolutely. There's been a lot of pressure. Now, many people in the American administration have been resisting making this move because if Assad wins and he remains there, how do you deal with him? And there are people in the administration, mostly retired, but people like Ambassador Crocker, who was our greatest diplomat for the last several decades, he said, we don't want to see the rebels win. So there's a big fight within the Obama administration over how to move on this. And we are seeing a lot of mixed messages. And one of them is going to the criminal court.
All right, Joshua, thank you for that update. And Rebecca, as always, for your insight.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this program and answer any questions you have for me, Joshua, or Rebecca. You can leave a comment on our website, kgou.org, or tweet us at WorldviewsKGOU. You can also get in touch with each of us at Suzette Gorlot, at Cruz226, and at Joshua_Landis. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest is David Lampton, a longtime China scholar who's currently serving at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's written more than a dozen works over the past three decades about Chinese society, politics, economics, and its relationship with its neighbors and the United States. Lampton's most recent book, Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping, humanizes the Chinese leaders through hundreds of interviews he conducted. It's an evolutionary picture specifying change and continuity in China to reveal the reality of a Chinese political system that's often frustrating to the country's leaders. David Lampton, welcome to Worldviews.
Good to be with you.
Tell us about this kind of evolutionary process and how it is that China, since 1977 and Deng Xiaoping's return to power, China has changed and how it stayed the same.
Well, I think the starting point is to realize, as your question did, where China was in 1977, July, when Deng Xiaoping came back after having been purged in the Cultural Revolution. And I date reform from that. And basically, China was behind India on many important indicators, per capita GDP, educational levels for the population, and so forth. It was almost indescribably poor. And I fast forward in the introductory chapter to then look at it in 2010. And basically, China has outstripped India and many other places and had really impressive growth, whether you look at it in terms of GDP, education, life expectancy, and so forth. So it's really a dramatic story that's lifted now 20%, but then when reform started, it was 25% of the world's population. So it's a dramatic story. And one of the things that comes out, I think, in the book is we often marvel at all the problems China has. And heaven knows some are not of leaders' making and some, frankly, are of Chinese leaders' making. And maybe one of the surprises is that China's been as successful as it's been given the problems its leaders face. And so this gets to your continuities. And certainly one of the continuities is just the absolute scale of what China's leaders are trying to manage. We consider Europe a collection of countries. China could be a Europe and a collection of countries. Instead, it's one country with a tradition of centralization. So China's leaders have to deal with a scale of administration that's absolutely unimaginable, and then it's structured in a bureaucracy. And every level of the bureaucracy distorts central policy as it's passed down. And so by the time your central directives get to the bottom of this huge pinball machine, in effect, your policies are rather distorted. Also, China wasn't dealt a very good hand, you might say, in terms of the piece of real estate it was put on. And I spent a lot of the book talking about the role that water hydrological disasters, seismological earthquakes and so on play in the daily life and weekly, yearly life of Chinese leaders. So those are great continuities. I think some of the discontinuities are, we just witnessed a couple years back, China's now a predominantly urban society. For all of its history up until about 2012, China was characterized and was a peasant society in substantial. So China's leaders are now trying to deal with the expectations of a massive urban influx, a massive middle class that's developing, highly educated people. There's a debate what the middle class in China is, but it's probably as big as the United States population. And that still leaves you with a billion poor people. So I'm not trying to create a false sympathy for Chinese leaders. They do lots of things we don't like and aren't in our interests, and maybe not even in our view their own interests. But I think at the same time, we need appreciation of what it is they're actually trying to govern.
I'm speaking with China analyst David Lampton from the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping, which just came out in February. More after a break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking with longtime China scholar David Lampton about his book, Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. Just before the break, he described how China's leaders are now trying to deal with the expectations of a massive urban influx and a highly educated developing middle class that's as large as the entire U.S. population. Well, you've touched on a number of changes, and clearly economic change is one of the main things that we've seen in China. And having been to China a couple of times myself and 6 years apart, I too can see how significantly things have changed there economically and the economic growth that's taken place, the reform that Deng Xiaoping began in the 70s, all of that economic change. But what about the political change and political reform? I mean, your book indicates that at least those that you interviewed indicated that these things were going on. Political reform was happening or is happening, but that it's less visible. It's kind of hidden and out of view. And from my own experience, I mean, it was hard to see as an outsider that there was any kind of political reform and change going on. But how is it that China has changed politically in terms of not just life expectancy, education, and GDP, but freedom of association, freedom of speech, voting. I mean, what are we to expect for this 1.3 billion people?
Well, I think it's a complicated story, but there's probably a big difference between when you say political reform or one says political reform, and I tend to use the phraseology political change. And you'll often hear people say there's been economic change in China of a massive character, but not much political change or political reform. And I think that is a generalization that actually hides more than it reveals. If you mean political reform and have in mind something like the first 10 amendments of the U.S. Constitution, which is certainly what I think most Americans would have, and indeed I think a fair meaning of the word, there hasn't been as much political reform. I think that stripped down to its essentials. But if you ask a different question, has there been political change? Is the system, I would say, different in important ways than when Mao died in 1976? I think the answer is yes. And the way in which it's different is very important. First of all, ask yourself the question, what did Mao Zedong try to control? answer everything. Now, in fact, he couldn't. But there was no zone of human activity to residence, to occupation, to your inner thoughts, to where your children would go to school. That was all controlled. There was no zone that was not the proper concern of government. Government couldn't always intervene because it didn't have enough capacity, but there was no forbidden zones. Now, if you ask, what does the Chinese government try to control? The answer is pretty much that it gets revenue, like all governments, and secondly, that it not face organized contestation for power. That's what the Chinese government cares about now. And they need economic growth to keep power, among other things, and meet the demands of the people. So I would say this, what the Chinese government is trying to control now is so much smaller than what it's trying to control before. We're kind of missing the biggest part of the picture. And that's a positive, humane outcome. Now, we all still don't have the 10 amendments here. But that another way to think about it is when Deng Xiaoping came back after Mao's death, essentially, I would say China had strong leaders, a very relatively homogeneous society, and society didn't have many resources to fight back against the system. And if you ask today, what does China have? It has relatively weaker leaders, although the current leader is trying to remedy that situation. It has a very fragmented bureaucracy and society, and a lot more resources are down at the bottom of society with giving people the capacity to resist in things that are not in their interest. Now, it's not democracy, it's not voting, but basically the very structure of the polity in many important respects has changed. Now, of course, you have a party, Communist Party, with 83 million people, and the organizational chart looks quite similar in many respects to what it looked like 40 years ago. So I'm not trying to exaggerate, but basically I think China's leaders have almost Lilliputian ambitions for control compared to Mao Zedong, and they face a society that can fight back.
Well, we've been focusing on kind of internal changes and perceptions among Chinese leaders and the Chinese society, but they also have certain perceptions about the outside world. You refer in your book about Chinese leaders and their thoughts about their relations with others. Certainly, you are an expert on U.S.-China relations and the very important relationship that has developed there, not only economically but politically. So tell us a little bit about what Chinese leaders think about everyone else that they're having to deal with. You know, because, again, as somebody who's been to China, it is somewhat insular in many ways. Yes. They don't seem to think much about what's going on around the world, but they really are. These leaders are thinking about the rest of the world.
Well, first of all, I think it's very perceptive to observe that China's leaders, in a sense, like leaders in many other societies, whether they stay in power or not is dependent on how their societies perceive them to be performing. And actually, that's true in China. It's not that linkage isn't created by elections. It's created by the possibility people will get out in the streets and cause a disorder. But there is a linkage between performance and popular sentiment in some sense. So in any case, the Chinese spend most of the time thinking about their domestic problems, and that includes the leaders. They're not sitting in Zhongnanhai, the leadership compound, wondering how they can confuse the lives of American leaders and frustrate our global ambitions. Occasionally, they do think about international affairs, and probably more than occasionally, and they have specialized bureaucracies that spend all their time thinking about it. But I would say if you look at most leaders, most of the time, they're worried about staying in the saddle of a very tumultuous domestic circumstance. So that's the first thing. They don't think. I've often had people from India ask me, what does China think about India? And I don't mean to be flip, but they don't spend much time thinking about India is the honest answer. The second thing you need to say is China pays particular attention to the degree that it's paying attention to foreign affairs to its periphery. And right now, relations with Japan and Vietnam and the Philippines, Korea, and of course, the United States is in an entirely different category. But China spends a lot of time thinking about its neighbors, although its policies aren't as skillful now as they used to be. Another theme is that when China looks at the big powers, particularly the United States, the word you hear time and time again is bullying. This is not delicately put, but they can't get past the 150 years from 1840 on when China was pushed around in the international system. And the vocabulary, whether it's the president or people all at much more modest system levels, all talk about the history of bullying China. And part of the legitimacy of the Communist Party is they're building up China's economic and military strength so China will never be bullied again. The never again club is very strong in China. So I think that's a sort of another. Now, this leads to the reaction to American policy, and that is they generally conceive of our policy now as trying to contain and limit China's resurgence to a place of equality and power in the world.
Well, in the last couple minutes we have, David, let's focus on China's future. What are we to expect in terms of China managing all these domestic issues, as you mentioned, the growing middle class, issues of corruption, which we haven't even touched on, military-civilian relationships? But how are they to manage all of that and this complicated relationship with their neighbors, what appears to be a desire to at least be a major player in its region? How are they going to bring all this together? What are we to expect from China?
Well, I think one of the first things to say is for the last 40 years, China has exceeded the expectations and predictions of almost everybody who has ventured to make any. China is in a place none of us imagined 40 years ago. So the first part is sort of humility. We're not very good at predicting. And my book doesn't really seek to predict. It tends to paint a few scenarios. I think the most optimistic is urbanization and globalization give China an interest in the rest of the world and in cooperation, interdependence, cooperating on climate change, keeping the global economy. That's the cooperative China is possible. I think there's a reasonable chance that, broadly speaking, that's the future that lies ahead. But, you know, I wouldn't put more than 50-50 on that. China could leaders could think that the internal stability cannot be taken for granted. You see its current leaders now trying to tighten up because of the massive urbanization, growth of the middle class, demands, internet, all of these things. And China could go back to its old playbook or could try. I don't think they can go back to anything remotely like Mao. But on the other hand, they could try the strongman playbook. And if they do that, they're going to alarm their neighbors. They're probably going to have a foreign policy that's less cooperative. And therefore, they're going to get pushback from the international system, as indeed they already are, in part from the United States, certainly from Japan, Vietnam, and the Philippines. So I think it's uncertain. And I try to tell my students, our job is to try to push towards the positive scenario, recognizing we're operating at the margins of a very big society with very big internal dynamics.
Well, David Lampton, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
You've been listening to my conversation with China scholar David Lampton. He's just published a book called Following the Leader that explores how China's explosive growth has affected its fragmented bureaucracy. You can see a lecture and watch his conversation with the president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies through a collaborative partnership with KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and we'd like to thank our graduating digital content intern, Nick Aguilera, for all his hard work over the past few months. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.